So, first I'd like to make an announcement. We will be starting giving personal interviews tomorrow. And so that's for the four teachers that are here. Soryu, I guess, is probably with somebody now. I think you all know where the sheets are. They're outside of the dining area. And we all have our own rooms. I'm in room number 11 right across there. And Rakefet, what's your room?
Building 3. There's a classroom in building 3.
Yeah, classroom in building 3, et cetera. So you can come and get to talk privately, one-on-one. That's good, and that will start tomorrow. let me see here. I wanted to clarify some things from this morning. Inevitably, the same questions come up over and over again. I have taught this material for many years, so I know exactly what the questions are and where the confusions lie. It's completely predictable. I have been told by educators that when you introduce a new concept to people, that new concept must be repeated at least 4 times, even if the person you're teaching is very smart. Even smart people, if it's brand new, have to hear it at least 4 times in a row before it starts to sink in, if it's a new concept. I will probably be introducing you to depending on how much background you have, I will be introducing you in this retreat to perhaps as many as 24 significant new concepts. So we'll have to go over things over and over again. However, I would claim that each new concept will well repay the effort that you'll have to put into it, because they represent the distillation, essence.
Les a kick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you do, they represent the distillation of my 40 years of experience teaching mindfulness to people. So I introduce to you the notion that you might on occasion have body sensations that seem to you at that time to be emotional. I mentioned that that's most likely to happen when you have a strong emotional experience. When you have a strong emotional experience, you can look to the body, you can turn your attention to the body, see what's going on there. The changes that take place, you now have a name for that, at least in English. I'm calling it feel. I did not say that you should sit here, go to your body, and try to find feel. I emphatically did not say to try to do that. And yet, quite a few of you have been trying to do that. The idea is to have a term for certain experiences that are significant and sometimes happen to people. So I will introduce you to a lot of categories of experience. I am not implying that you have to find those categories. I'm just giving you a word for them if they happen to be present. Tomorrow, I'm going to teach you how to work with your mental experience. One of the categories I'm going to give you is visual thoughts, image. You may not have very many visual thoughts, but if you do, you have a word for it. So, is that clear? It's a long-term goal to have a precise vocabulary that covers all these significant sensory experiences that a person goes through. We give you these words so that you'll have terms for things when they come up, perhaps not at this retreat, but sometimes in the future. You notice that when I had you meditate, I said, if you happen to have emotion in the body, you can note that as feel. But if you don't, you certainly have touch. And you can always go back to that. So there's always something that you can focus on in your body. It doesn't really matter what you focus on. All that matters is that when you focus on it, you bring concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity to it. And I will define what I mean by those terms this evening. So if all you ever focused on was the touch of your breath, but you developed concentration power, equanimity, and clarity with regards to that single phenomenon, that would be an entire path. Or perhaps broadly, just any touch. Or perhaps broader still, just anything in the body. Okay? Doesn't matter how broad or narrow, it's not a big deal. My style is that I like to give people a wide range of categories and techniques. But all you have to do is find one category and one technique that works for you. You don't have to work with everything that I'm talking about. You don't have to practice all the techniques. In fact, you don't have to practice any of them. You'll remember on the first day I said, I don't care how you meditate, whatever works for you. There's no required way of working. However, I will introduce a way of working. It will be very comprehensive and extremely precise. I would claim that mindfulness is a science of sensory experience. It brings to our sensory experience the same method that science brings to the objective world. But we're dealing with sensory experience. That's all we're ever going to be dealing with. So we are not concerned with what should be in experience. We're only concerned with what actually is in experience. A given person's experience at a given moment. That means that if when you have an emotion, you are unable to detect any feel, unable to detect any mental picture or any talk, that means that that's okay. Those phenomena are not available for you in the senses right now. So don't worry about that. But there'll always be something in your senses. I promise you. If nothing else, you will be hot tonight. That's available in your senses. So you can focus on that. I don't know if you have the idiom in Hebrew, but in English, we talk about the tip of the iceberg. You have this way of talking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, there may be this giant thing. All you're aware of is this little tip. Or maybe you're just aware of that much of it. Or maybe it's there, but you're not aware of it at all. It's below the waters of unconsciousness. If I give you a sensory category like feel or image, image will be visual thinking, it is possible that for you, those will be at this time below the waters of unconsciousness. Not even the tip of the iceberg is there. That's okay. Don't worry about that. Other things are there. That's what you focus on. As you're paying attention to your senses, maybe you have no feel, okay? But then at some point, some strong emotion happens in your life, and it's like, oh yeah, there's a little something here, there's a little something here. And oh yeah, that's the body part of my emotion. Yeah, it seems trivial. It seems vague, but yeah, I do see something changed in my body. Now you've detected the tip of the iceberg. Now you know where to look. Days pass, weeks pass, months pass, years pass. Gradually, the water of unconsciousness gets dried up and exposes something very deep and very broad. But you don't have to worry about this now. If you can get the tip of the iceberg, that's all you need to look at. If you can't get the tip of the iceberg, don't even worry about it. Much of our sensory experience is below the threshold of consciousness. What mindfulness does is it elevates, you develop what I call sensory clarity. That elevates your ability to detect things that perhaps at this point are unconscious. If at this point they're unconscious, you don't have to worry about it. Just go with whatever is available. Does that make sense? Okay. Have notes to myself. You have probably noticed in your life when you attempt to pay attention to something that's important for you in daily life, sometimes you're able to pay attention, but sometimes you find that you're not able to pay attention. You're pulled away and you're scattered. How many people have noticed in ordinary life, sometimes you're able to focus on what's relevant, other times it's difficult to do so? How many people have noticed that? We've all noticed that. The ability to focus on what you want, when you want, for as long as you want to. Does that sound like a useful ability in human life? In terms of subjective experience and in terms of objective behavior or performance, both subjectively and objectively, we find life is much better when we're able to fully focus on what we deem relevant. So let's have a word that has that means the ability to focus on what you want to, whenever you want to, for as long as you want to. Let's call that concentration power. Let's further define baseline of concentration power. Baseline of concentration power is how strong that ability is when you're not trying to concentrate, when you're not working at it. Just what's available for you. When you lift weights, if you lift weights every day, and you lift them properly, you have a coach that shows you how to do it so that you're doing the exercise right, your muscles will get strong. That strength will be available for you when you go about your life. You don't have to go back to the gym, pump a lot of iron in order to be strong. Your base level of strength has been elevated, raised, by daily practice. Does this make sense? Concentration power is like a muscle. We exercise it in a systematic way, and with time, the base level gets stronger and stronger. So that in daily life, without having to work at it, you'll find that you can be 2 or 3 or 4 times more concentrated automatically. Concentration power is one of the skills that make up mindfulness. However, concentration power is not unique to the mindfulness tradition. All forms of meditation around the world have at their core the development of concentration power. So it's universal. The way that the concentration power is developed, however, differs from tradition to tradition. Some people will do it with a mantra. Some people will do it with a visualization. Some people will do it through a secular activity like music, dance. In a sense, it doesn't matter. You find the vehicle that best works for you. Some people develop concentration power just by focusing on the breath at their nose. But if you develop concentration power just by focusing on the breath there or there, you'll discover that you can concentrate on anything. You may develop it in one location, but it is a general skill that will then be available for you wherever you want to apply it. The exercise I gave you, so how do you develop concentration? Well, you develop strength by lifting weights against gravity. You have to work. Gravity pulls down, you pull up, the muscles get strong with time. You decide on an object of focus. It could be broad or it could be narrow. It could be anything. Touch, feel, image, talk, okay? External sights, external sounds. Or some combination, or some subset thereof. You decide on something for a period of time. Your attention is pulled elsewhere, bring it back. Gently. Your attention is pulled elsewhere, bring it back. Each time you bring it back, you're lifting a weight. You're working against the force of distraction, developing your concentration muscle. It's as simple as that. And it doesn't matter what you're focusing on. It's a general skill. You keep coming back. Does that make sense? So in that regard, mindfulness is no different from any kind of meditation. As I understand it, in the Kabbalistic tradition, the focus power or concentration power was called kavana, meaning directing your attention, which is like kivun, right? You have a direction. So that's a general term. And some of the Kabbalistic masters said without kavana, you don't have, it's not really a spiritual path. You're just all over the place. So that's one of the skills that we will be learning, and that is certainly a very useful skill. But there's more to mindfulness than mere concentration power. There is a quality that in English we call equanimity. Now, I was talking to Rakefet, and she said, well, there's no good Hebrew translation for equanimity. To which I said, that's not a problem, because there's no good English translation of equanimity. Shivyon.
This is what it's commonly used, but it's very misleading.
Well, we're not going to get into pilpul. First, let me give you my opinion before I let you fight about your opinions. What does shivyon actually literally mean?
Equal.
Equal. Okay, so we'll start there. But I'm going to write notes. By the way, you can take notes, I can take notes. So, shin, yod, vav,
double
vav, vav,
yud,
nun,
vav nun,
yeah, vav nun. Yes, equality. Okay, shivyon.
In nefesh.
I understand nefesh. It's a soul. Okay. Right, I left off a shivyo.
Yes.
I said that? Okay. Shivyo nefesh. Well, we'll see if this corresponds. In point of fact, although we use the word equanimity in English, it's completely confusing and misleading to English speakers. We have exactly the same problem. Because what the word equanimity in English literally means is exactly shivyon. It means balance. Aequo in Latin, aequo anima. Aequo means balanced, as in aequatio, or equation, or equilibrium. And anima is the nefesh, exactly nefesh. Okay. So yes, shivyon nefesh would be aequo anima in Latin, a literal translation of what that word means in Latin, with a balanced consciousness. However, the issue is, what does balance mean in this case? There's an ambiguity to the word balance. I would say that shivyon nefesh is probably a pretty good translation of equanimity. But equanimity may not be the right word for the quality that we call equanimity. Okay, is everybody completely confused? Now we're confused in two languages. Humans have been confused about this for a long, long time. Humans, not English speakers, not Hebrew speakers, humans have been confused about this for a long, long time. Equanimity is a word that's used to translate upeksha in Sanskrit, or upeka in Pali. But then the issue is, well, what does that mean, etc., etc. So let me let's start with the notion of balance, since you brought that up. Balance in what sense? Well, the way it's usually interpreted as balance in the sense of I don't lose my composure and freak out, okay, or I can keep my cool, okay. But I would suggest to you that there's a much deeper meaning to balance here. That if you say to the average speaker of English, if you talk about equanimity, here's what they think you mean. They think you mean that you don't show any emotion on the outside. That's equanimity. Or worse still, they think you mean that you suppress your emotions. Or worse still, they think you mean that you are indifferent to conditions, your personal conditions and the conditions of life. Unfortunately, those are the connotations in English of the word equanimity. But that's, none of those are what we're talking about. There is not a good word for it. So let's look a little bit deeper into balance by asking ourselves the opposite. What does it mean to be unbalanced? Equanimity is a relationship to sensory experience. I repeat, equanimity is a relationship to sensory experience, as we will be using this term, however it may be used elsewhere in the world. I repeat, for the third time, equanimity is a relationship to sensory experience, as we will be using it. It has absolutely nothing to do with whether we express or don't express. On the outside, it's not the ability to keep your cool. I told you in Theravada Buddhism, you're nailing, you hit your thumb, how do you express your equanimity? In Zen, you're nailing, you hit your thumb, how do you express your equanimity? Ouch! Okay. On the inside, those are identical. On the outside, they look completely different. Because equanimity is a relationship to sensory experience. Now you heard it for four times. Should be getting it. The person that says, ouch, but is having a complete experience of that sensation is not suffering. They have equanimity. Okay? The person that shows no emotion, but has a complete experience, is not suffering. They have equanimity. The person that shows no emotion but is denying and suppressing what's going on doesn't have equanimity, even though they're not showing anything. And the person that goes, ah, god damn it, hell, okay, they're expressing, okay, but on the inside they have no equanimity. They're blowing off steam. There's a difference between Zen spontaneity and blowing off steam. Okay? So, how do we lose balance with regards to our sensory experience? Well, loss of balance means fall to the right or fall to the left. That means two opposites. So, one of the opposites is a sensory experience arises and we inappropriately hold on to it. It arises, it's about to go, but we lock on and hold when there's no need to. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a pleasant experience. We may be addicted to holding on too long to unpleasant experiences also. It becomes habitual. So one way you lose balance is by identifying with something and letting it, hold it longer than need be. It's about to pass, but you won't let it pass. The other way we lose balance is something is trying to arise and we stuff it down. We don't just let it express itself. So that's why one metaphor for equanimity, which I was talking about, is it's a metaphor. You're standing back, you let the experience arise without suppressing, you let the experience pass when it's time for it to pass without holding. That is merely a metaphor for equanimity. If I were to give my own definition of equanimity, I would not define it in terms of balance. I just did this for you because of what the words mean in Latin, and the shivyon nefesh in that it corresponds to that in Hebrew. I wouldn't go in about balance. I would use a different metaphor, a completely different metaphor. So any of you know what Ohm's law is? And I don't mean like Om Mani Padme Hum, Ohm. I mean the Georg Simon Ohm, the German physicist, OHM's law. You know what that is?
No.
Okay, well, don't worry. You will in a minute. Ohm's law describes how electrical current works. There's voltage, and then voltage is like a force. And in the wire presents resistance to the force. And therefore, even though there might be a lot of voltage, not much current can flow if there's a lot of electrical resistance. And in fact, the unit of electrical resistance is called ohm. And for those of you with the engineering background, you also know that there's a generalization of that to something called impedance. Okay? So I would claim that within our sensory experience, what do I mean by sensory experience? Touch, sight, sound, feel, image, talk. Within our sensory experience, those and certain interesting restful experiences that I'll be teaching you about, within ordinary sensory experience and pleasant restful states, there is something like electrical, something like resistance in the sensory wires. And it impedes the natural flow of sensory experience. Now, what, those of you with the background in electrical engineering, what's the reciprocal of resistance? The opposite of resistance is called, it starts in English with a C, conductance. That's correct. The opposite of resistance is conductance. What's resistance? Electrical resistance. And what is the reciprocal, meaning the opposite? Molichut? Okay, very good. Equanimity is to, what was the word for conductance? Wait, I will learn that. Mo?
You're looking for the noun?
Yes.
Molich. From lalechet, from to go.
To what?
Molich is from walking or making a path.
Making a path.
Yeah, but this is the component, the
resistors and so the opposite is
olacha. Olacha is the when the olacha. Electrons are going, it's olacha. The stuff that's conducting it is molich.
Okay, that's a conductor. So conductance,
yeah,
or conductivity olacha. Is?
Conductivity is olacha.
Molichut?
Molichut.
We'll look it up.
Whatever.
Moli. Let's see if I got it. Moli. Okay. Molichut. Equanimity is to your sensory circuits as molichut is to an electrical circuit. Okay? Equanimity is the dropping of the internal friction to sensory experience. But you don't understand what I'm talking about because you're not aware that there is sensory friction. We have an idiom in English. I don't know if you have this in Hebrew, but it's it's catch 22. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like it's a problem that there's no way around. If you try to do this, it doesn't work. If you try to do this, it doesn't work. We call that a catch-22. It's from a Kurt Vonnegut novel.
It's not Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah. Vonnegut?
Joseph Heller.
Heller? Oh, sorry. Okay. Whatever. Hey, good! You know what I'm talking about. I stand corrected, and happily so. Okay, catch-22. Here's the catch-22. Until you sit down and fall into an experience of equanimity, you don't realize that you haven't had it before, okay? In other words, until the conductivity suddenly appears, you don't realize resistance has been there your whole life, okay? So it's hard to understand what I'm talking about. So what's he talking about? I'm not aware that there's anything like friction in how my senses flow. I mean, my senses are just my senses. But remember I described to you the first time I ever did a long retreat, okay? On the last day of the retreat, the resistance in my pain circuits went away. And there was just the flow of pain, and it tasted like purification. It did not taste like suffering. And when you go into equanimity with pleasant experiences, it also tastes like purification, and the sensory experience delivers enormous satisfaction. So what people think they want is to avoid pain and find pleasure. But what it turns out we really want is to avoid suffering, which we can't avoid even if we can't avoid pain. Because if you have pain with equanimity, it doesn't hurt. Now you say, wait, now you're talking nonsense. That's an oxymoron. That's a contradictory, you see what I mean? But pain means hurt. That's the catch-22. Until you've experienced pain without it hurting, until you've experienced pain and you say, does it hurt? Yes. Is that a problem? No. Until you have that experience, you can't appreciate what equanimity is. In the same way, until you've had pleasure with equanimity, and it's like, does it feel good? Yes. Well, what's the difference? It fulfills me more than pleasure did, than the same pleasure before. When you have equanimity with pleasure, you get greater fulfillment from the pleasure. When you have equanimity with the pain, you derive less suffering from the pain. So that it turns out what we really want as humans is to avoid suffering and to have fulfillment. And we can have that even if we can't avoid pain or get intense pleasure. We can derive enormous fulfillment from small pleasures. When I went into the temple, every morning we had exactly the same breakfast. We had rice porridge. I don't know, maybe if you have something like that here. We had rice porridge, a pickled plum, a pickled daikon. It's a kind of turnip. And some miso soup. So the first morning in the temple, that's what I had for breakfast. Second morning in the temple, that's what I had for breakfast. After 3 months, same thing for breakfast. Okay, every day, exactly the same. Now, I don't know how it is here, but in North America, it's like, well, shall we have eggs hollandaise today? Shall we have Belgian waffles tomorrow? Shall we have blintzes? Shall we have this? Shall we have that? It's got to be something new every morning, right? So this is a very different concept of breakfast. Exactly the same thing every day. I knew something was changing in me when, after 6 months, every morning when I would wake up, I would look forward to that rice porridge. It was like, oh boy, rice porridge! What I was learning is how to take a very simple pleasure and derive enormous fulfillment from it. Like here, we had the meals in silence and chant before, and it says if you eat, so Buddhist monks live by begging. People give you dana. It's still the custom. That's how I live. You give me dana at the end of the retreat. So, but you've heard of a Jewish guilt trip. I'm sure you've heard this phrase, okay? I hope you, well, at least in the United States, we have this phrase, okay? Jewish guilt trip, and everybody laughs when you say it, okay? So let me tell you what a Buddhist guilt trip is.
Guilt trip.
Yes, can you explain? A Buddhist guilt trip. Guilt trip means your Yiddish mama makes you feel guilty about something. Okay,
that's a garden in Africa.
Yeah, right.
In Israel, it's a Polish mama.
I see, it's your Polska mama, or what have you. Well, in the United States, it's your Jewish mother makes you guilty about this and that. You know, you never wrote, you never this, you never. Okay, so that's a racial stereotype that we ourselves maintain. Okay, so we have this expression, Jewish guilt trip. So here is a Buddhist guilt trip. When you eat your meal, before in the chanting, it says, if I'm not mindful while I eat this porridge, I have stolen the dana from the faithful. I'm a ganav. Okay? So it's like, oh, I better concentrate on what I'm eating, or I'm living as a thief. So because of that mentality, I discovered that I was enjoying that rice porridge much more than I enjoyed Belgian waffles or Eggs Benedict or Canadian bacon or whatever it was that I always looked forward to in North America. What was I learning? I was learning how to have a lot of concentration, clarity, and equanimity when I ate, so that I was deriving greater fulfillment from small pleasures. So, as I say, we think we want to avoid pain and find pleasure. We meaning humanity. But at a deeper level, what we really want is to avoid suffering. That's pain as a problem. When you have pain with equanimity, the suffering goes down and a new taste arises. It's called the taste of purification. There's a sense that because of how you're being in this moment with this pain, every moment of your life to come is going to be better because holdings from the past are getting worked through. That's the taste of purification, vishuddhi, in the Sanskrit language, purification. When you have pleasure with equanimity, you also get the sense of purification. Every moment in the future is going to be more fulfilling because of how I'm experiencing this moment. So, equanimity is a deep concept. As I say, it's linked to the notion of balance, but it's more comparable to a physical variable in the nervous system. It's like learning how to reduce friction in a mechanical system, or reduce drag in a hydraulic system, or reduce resistance in an electrical circuit. That's how I would try to describe as best I can what equanimity is. How you learn equanimity is you don't. It happens to you. And then you notice the difference. You're sitting there and it's pain and you're suffering, it's pain and you're suffering, and then suddenly it's pain and you're not suffering. And it's like, well, what happened? Well, something deep down in the sensory circuits sort of opened spontaneously. And it's like, oh, I see. I am now in more of a state of equanimity. And the longer you sit, the more likely it is going to happen. And the more frequently it happens, the more frequently still it happens. Until it just takes off. And you start to live for the taste of purification. You start to live for freedom from suffering and greater fulfillment, rather than living for a freedom from pain and greater pleasure. It's a real change in one's relationship to sensory experience.
Can you repeat
this? Oh yes, I can repeat this many, many times. this is one of those things, it's like E equals MC squared. Professor Einstein, could you run that by us again? That was sort of quick, okay? human beings, with regards to their bodies, live in order, their goal in for the body is avoid pain and find pleasure. Once you start to understand about equanimity, a change takes place in your value system. You'll still avoid pain, and you'll still find pleasure. But more important, you realize, I want to avoid suffering due to pain. And when I have pain with equanimity, I don't suffer as much. And you realize, I don't just want intensity, variety, and duration of pleasure. I want another quality called being really satisfied by the pleasure. So a change takes place in your perspective, your Weltanschauung, your sort of overview or paradigm of paradigm? Of things.
Can you give an example how you separate?
No, that sounds flippant, but it's can't give an example. You have to see it yourself in your own experience. It's like a person comes from a planet where it's always below the freezing of water. Okay, that person. Imagine a person that comes to this. Imagine a person coming to this planet, on whose planet water is always ice, okay? We try to explain to that person what the word water means. All they will ever know is that we're talking about ice. They won't have a sense of water flowing in a river. They won't have a sense of water as steam, because H2O on their planet always means ice. Until you actually drop into equanimity, pain will always be suffering, because it's always frozen. Okay? You don't understand what fluid pain is like until it happens to you. But as you're observing, it will happen to you. Okay? So I can't say, oh, when this happened to you, you know, it's this and this other thing. However, if you think back upon your life, it's possible that sometime in your life, something very uncomfortable happened, and you just, for whatever reason, didn't fight it, and it didn't bother you as much. If you can think back of an instance in your life where that happened, you dropped into equanimity. Then that was equanimity. That's good. That would be an instance of equanimity. Well, it can involve a decision, but that's part of it. So, let's say you're sitting and you have pain. If you can make a decision, okay, just let the pain be there, then that's equanimity. Okay? Then the pain gets more, okay? If you can make a decision, okay, let's let the pain be there, then that's equanimity. Now the pain is getting so intense that your whole body is shaking, and it's going on, okay? If you can make a decision, that's okay, then that's equanimity. Okay. However, you may come to a point where you can't make that decision anymore. Instead, in your mind, it's like, no, no, no! Screaming in your head, okay? And you cannot make that decision anymore. You can still stay with it, and at some point, the screaming no will go away of its own, and the body will relax. Then you have fallen into equanimity. Not just equanimity with the physical sensation, but with the talk, the image, the feel, the whole gestalt, of the whole body-mind complex. So yes, there is on the surface a place for decision, but at a deeper level it goes into the circuits themselves. Okay? So now some understanding is starting to arise. Equanimity is not just something that is applied to pleasure and pain in the body. Because we don't just have a body, we also have a mind. The mind suffers when it's confused and doesn't have answers. Just like the body suffers when it has discomfort. One can learn to have equanimity with not having answers. That's equanimity with the mind. You can just let confusion be in your mind without needing to have an answer. You might say, well, that's awful. Why would anybody want to do that? Well, you do this retreat, you go home, and you talk to a friend. They say, what happened at the retreat? And you say, well, my legs hurt horribly, but I dropped into equanimity and it was wonderful. And they say,
good for you.
They say, you're meshuggah, okay? You're crazy. What are you talking about? But you had that experience and it was a positive. Now, even if you've had the experience of your body dropping into equanimity, if I say to you, I guess what? When confusion and don't know arise in your mind, you can just let that be there without fighting it. Now you look at me and you say, you're crazy. I can see it in the body, but my mind, that's me. If I don't have an answer moment by moment, what will become of me? I'll be, helpless, ineffectual. However, all over the world, there is a word for a positive relationship to not knowing, believe it or not. In Zen, they'll ask you, bring me the sound of one hand clapping. What? Just keep that mind. What? Just keep that mind. What mind? That confused mind. Just let that be. Accepting not knowing in the mind is mental equanimity. Now but why should you do that? What would happen if for a period of time you let go of the need to have answers? Did you listen carefully? I said for a period of time. I didn't say forever and ever. What about for 1 hour? Or 1 day? You let go of the need to have answers. You might discover that, strangely enough, as the result of that, you start to think in a new creative way. Insights that would not have happened otherwise start to happen to you. Why should you believe that this is true? Well, there is no reason you should believe this is true until you experience it. But you're unlikely to experience it unless you believe it's true. Catch 22. So most people never learn this. However, it has been discovered at least 3 times individually, or independently, starting, surprisingly, perhaps, with the Western world. The first mention of the notion of equanimity with thoughts, or suspending the need to have answers, occurred in ancient Greece. There was a school of philosophers who were anti-philosophers. They said, don't seek answers, don't argue about or speculate about what is, take an opposite approach. Suspend the need to know, and you will begin to know in a deeper way with time. These people were called skeptics. The modern meaning in English of the word skeptic is completely different. In modern English, skeptic means somebody who doubts. But in ancient Greece, originally, skeptic meant skeptikos, somebody who just observes, skepsis, okay? Someone who just observes and lets go of the need to have answers in order to have answers in a new way. It's a whole school of approach that historically first appears, before it appears in Asia, it appeared in ancient Greece. There is a word in Greek that means the following sentence in English. The systematic of the need to know in order to know in a new and deeper way. That's a mouthful. The systematic suspending of the need to know in order to know in a new and deeper way is a long sentence in English. And it is a 3-syllable word in Greek. Epoche. E-P-O-C-H-E. Actually, in ancient Greece, it would be epoche, which means suspended. They did this as a spiritual practice. They, meaning the school called skeptics. Fast forward, go halfway around the world, Tang Dynasty China, Zen, or Chan, developed out of Buddhism coming into China. And they developed these practices called koans, the sound of one hand clapping, show me your original face, mu, manifest mu. What's mu? Keep that don't know mind. Only keep don't know mind. You never figure out what mu is, okay? You just lose the need to know what mu is. And then something manifests in front of the Zen master that's magic, comes out of nowhere. There's no connection historically whatsoever between the skeptics' practice of epoche in ancient Greece and the Tang Dynasty Chinese Chan Zen practice of don't know mind. Just an independent discovery. Come back to this part of the world, or not quite this far east. Medieval Europe. In Christianity, okay, that you hear you have monasteries, Catholic and Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox monasteries, right over there on Har Tavor. There's both Eastern Orthodox Greek and Roman Catholic monasteries. What did the Christians do in those monasteries? They practiced something called docta ignorantia. In Latin, that means systematic not knowing. Docta means learned or practiced. Ignorantia is the basis of the English word ignorance. They suspended in order to have a direct experience of God. According to St. Thomas Aquinas, who is in Catholicism the final authority in philosophy, Deum tamquam per ignorantium cogniscimus. They spoke in Latin in those days. That means we know God directly, Deum. We know God directly tamquam per ignorantium, through a kind of not knowing. There's even a book in English called The Cloud of Unknowing. If you want to know God, you unknow everything for a period of time. So equanimity is not just something that you do in your body. You also allow your thoughts to come and go without pushing and pulling. Even if they're chaotic, it's something you do in your mind. When you have equanimity in your body suffers less and is more fulfilled. When you have equanimity with your thoughts, just letting them come and go without push and pull, you discover you're thinking more wisely. Sound like a good deal? So there are two characteristics that I've talked about so far, concentration power and equanimity. There is a third skill in mindfulness, besides the concentration and the equanimity. I'll take it in a second. The third skill is sensory clarity. You can think of sensory clarity as the ability to separate the components of your experience. When you're having, let's say, when you're having an experience, what part is touch? What part is sight? What part is sound? What part is feel? What part is image? What part is talk? Your ability to track sensory components, that's clarity. And just as your baseline of concentration can be elevated with practice, your baseline of equanimity can be elevated with practice, in the same way, your baseline of sensory clarity can be elevated with practice. So these three skills, concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity, these three skills taken together constitute mindful awareness. So now you have one definition of mindful awareness, one possible definition. What you don't have is a complete theory as to why one should bother spending time doing this. What's the purpose of it? And you don't yet have a complete description of how you go about developing these. But we got to start somewhere, so we're going to start with what, okay? What is mindful awareness? So mindfulness practice elevates your base level of concentration, clarity, and equanimity. Base level means how clear, equanimous, and concentrated you are when you're not trying, just as you're going about daily life. So that's a place to start. We now have a beginning of a what. Tomorrow I'll talk about why, how, when, who, etc., etc. Okay, we are done, and we'll take a little break and come back for a